Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is John Greenberg. He's the founding editor-in-chief of The Atlantic Chicago, and he's out with a new book, Chicago Cubs Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Triumph. They put out such great sports books, and these If the Walls Could Talk is a series of books about different teams. But John, as you go ahead and look at the Chicago Cubs, I think for a lot of Cubs fans, including myself, we see it as almost a BC and an AD era. There's before Theo Epstein and after Theo Epstein. Is that kind of how the media sees it, or and how your research for this book and your journalism for this book panned out?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think in a lot of ways, yeah. I mean, you know, local media obviously has, you know, they've been around a long time, have the memories of, you know, what's happened before and everything pretty clearly. And that's kind of what I try to do in my book, is draw a line between those two eras, you know, specifically the Hendry era, you know, and the Theo era, because that's really, in a lot of ways, modern Cub baseball, you know, in that starting in 03 and really after 03, you know, trying to build a winner every year because the expectations, you know, had changed around here. I think 03 really showed everyone what it was like to have a real playoff run and to have that World Series dream, like, right in front of you, actually, and not just be a punchline. So, you know, that was kind of where I started, was after that 03 season.
Well, and it seems like, as I read your book, maybe my memory's fogged, the Hendry era wasn't that awful.
No, you're right. It's kind of funny because I think those years, I was a young reporter when I started, and I just remember the tension I felt, like, every time I went to Wrigley, especially in 04 and then even 05 and 06, as things really took a downturn. And it seemed a lot worse than it was. But 05 and 06 were really bad. I mean, those were as bad as it gets, because you had the injuries to Wood and Pryor. And those guys, you know, the franchise was built around them, really. I mean, you had Derek Lee and Moises as this all-stars at the corners, but you know, the franchise hopes were built flexing and so long-lasting. I think it really colored the rest, you know, kind of that era.
Well, and it seems like those injuries, when they happen and your team's built around them, you know, every team has injuries, but was it part of the curse or something? Or why did those particular injuries affect the Cubs so magnificently, that it really devastated them?
Yeah, and, you know, I think in some ways that was part of the problem. You know, Jim was really good at a lot of things, but they just had, you know, he'll never complain about his budget, but it was a lot lower, you know, and they if you missed on something, you didn't really have that money to backfill. And I think a lot of the problems, you know, we saw this with the Bulls too, with Derrick Rose, and I've talked about it with the current Cubs regime. You know, when you do plan, you know, you budgeted and you kind of build around certain people and they get hurt, it does become a lot tougher to do, especially, you know, it comes a lot tougher to kind of accomplish what you want to accomplish. It's tough to kind of change gears or, you know, like that in the middle of it. So I think that was kind of, you know, it was only those 2 years, though, really, because, right, 05 wasn't that bad of a year. They finished around 500. 06 was just an awful year, and that was kind of a start over. Yeah, it was a start over year. Derek Lee was hurt a lot of that year. And then they rebooted immediately and went, you know, 07, they make the playoffs with an 87 win team. And then 2008, best team in baseball. So it was pretty amazing how they kind of did build. You know, they kind of, I remember very vividly when Lou Piniella came in, and he just did not want to talk about Wood and Pryor. He was basically, and it was right, it was good, and it was necessary. He was just like, if they're not here, we're not talking about them. And that's kind of what I think the media needed, and what the fans needed, and even what, you know, Wood and Pryor needed.
Well, a lot of the talk about Theo Epstein is how he builds the farm system and the way he drafts. How does his theory of drafting compare to Hendry?
I mean, it was completely, you know, from what they've said and what I've heard from the people in the Theo regime, they always respected Hendry. They like Hendry a lot, like everyone that deals with him. He's a wonderful guy, and he's a great deal maker. They said they would worry about him with free agency, you know, because he could close any deal. They would not worry about him with the draft. And eventually that kind of changed a little bit toward the end with Tim Wilkin in charge. You know, they would, they went with some weird guys. I don't really know if they had a philosophy. They just went with some guys that failed, you know. And before Tim Wilkin came, whoever the scouting director was before, I forget the name right now, but, you know, they drafted guys. I remember they used to see people saying, like, they were drafting guys they would never draft. Like, they would see, they would just weren't, the Hendry people maybe weren't looking deep enough at things, like arm slot when the guy's throwing. Like, you know, they're just looking, I don't know if they're looking more at results or just more at feel. Like, oh, I feel like this guy's going to be good. Because they did whiff on a bunch. But I will say the Hendry and Wilkin group, they hit on a lot of stuff after the first round. You know, second round to, like, fifth round. You can see they had a lot of major leaguers. And these were guys they wound up trading in a lot of sense, in a lot of cases, like Josh Donaldson. But they did pretty good. And they did pretty good in the Dominican and in Venezuela. They hit on a lot of guys, actually. And if you look, you know, we talk about that in the book, they had their hits as well. But, yeah, they, you know, that last 11 draft, you know, you look at it, their first two picks, that was Tim Wilkin's last draft in charge and Hendry's, you know, last draft. He didn't take a lot of credit for the drafts. But they got Javi Baez and Daniel Vogelbach, who's, you know, now an all-star in the first two rounds. So not too bad.
Well, and it seems like since during the Epstein era, the Epstein regime, they aren't hitting in the middle rounds like they were, right?
No. Yeah, that's been a big problem. And they've made some changes in their scouting, pro and amateur. They've flipped some people around into new roles. The same people are still in charge. But, yeah, I think it's a source of tension, you know, between Jason McLeod sometimes and Theo Epstein, who are long, long-time friends. But, you know, they just haven't hit on those guys. Now, right now, as we're talking about this, since the book's been written, it does look like they have some decent prospects. You know, they had Adbert Alzolay, who pitched this year, finally. And Miguel Mayas in the Futures game. Nico Horner's a shortstop out of Stanford. They've started to build it up, and we're starting to hear of more and more guys in the minors. I mean, they got this guy, Rupo Garcia, you know, who's they found playing for the Italian League national team, even though he's not from Italy. He was playing for the Italian national team, and now he's hit two home runs with the Cubs, which is kind of a cool story.
I'm chatting with John Greenberg about his new book, If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Chicago Cubs Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box. It's available now wherever fine books are sold from the good folks at Triumph. You know, one of the interesting things, you take us really inside, I mean, this is a lot of inside baseball in here, and you take us inside the stadium itself. They did this major renovation. They changed the bullpen, and they put the bullpen out in the outfield where they're not around the fans anymore like they used to. And you have interesting conversations with Ryan Dempster kind of sprinkled throughout this book. How important was that when that bullpen was right on the side? They were right next to the fans, and a lot of them would chat it up.
It was great. I mean, I don't think it did. It's probably better for those guys to have weather-controlled environment back there to warm up. But there is that, and that's the beauty of Wrigley, is there's a human touch. And I think that's why people love it. And that's not just why it's not just a stadium to go to a game at. It's a place that people love, and they have great memories of, and they have good times there. And I think that bullpen on the side was part of it. You know, like you said, Ryan Dempster would talk about how he became friends with fans, friendly with fans. And he got to know these people. And in some sense, he said, that kind of hurt him in 08 because he was thinking about these fans as he's trying not to walk seven guys in the NLDS. But it was fun, you know, and it was fun for us because we could see who's warming up at all times.
What was the pressure in 2016 on this team to win?
A ton, and it was amazing how they handled it, and that's what differentiated this Cubs team. Talent helped too, but that really differentiated this Cubs team from ones before it, because in 08 they choked. 07, they weren't as good. They still got swept. You know, 03, obviously, you know what happened there at the end with the choking, basically. This was different, man. These guys were built for this pressure. And, you know, I remember talking to Theo at, you know, sitting together at Sloan Park, their spring training, and he was like, bring it on. He's like, why would we, like, try to lie and say there's no pressure to win a World Series this year? Like, it's obvious. You know, you went to the NLCS the year before. You add free agents. Like, he wasn't ducking it. And I think that top-down mentality helped. And I think you really just had some confident guys in that group. You had the young guys that don't really know any better. And you had veterans that had actually won World Series. And I think that was a big deal, having these guys that had won a World Series in Boston where the pressure is, you know, intense. that was kind of the thing. And Ben Zobrist, who just won in Kansas City, that they felt so confident. And let's be honest, this 20, you start 25-6, you know, then you have a right to be confident. And that gave them the cushion, you know, to really not worry. If they don't start that hot, it could be a different story.
You mentioned Zobrist, and he's got a lot of personal stuff going on with his divorce now, but I've never, maybe I haven't paid attention close enough, but guys play through divorces all the time. What's going on with Zobrist?
Yeah, and they've kept it pretty personal, and I think most of us, even like in, you know, these kind of side conversations you have with people where they kind of explain reasoning with you, it hasn't really happened, at least to my knowledge this year. I've heard some theories, and none that I should probably share, but like, I mean, it's more mundane stuff about when you're going through a divorce and custody and things. But you know, here's the thing. Zobrist is 38. A lot of us think that he might be done after this year. You know, his career is fading. He was kind of heading towards the end. He has kids. He's very, you know, he's a very religious guy. He's a very family-oriented guy. He's a wonderful person. So I don't know what's going on. Like, you're right. It's weird that I figured that it would be like 2 weeks. You know, and he needs to take some time, and they've given him that because he's 38. And he's a veteran. But something, you know, something was in there. He didn't want to play, but they're saying he's coming back. You know, and I've heard he's been working out, you know, at Wrigley, and he's going to, I think now the point is he's not coming back till September when rosters expand. And I think that might, you know, I think he might be ready, but I think that might have been the deal they made.
Well, then, before I let you go, I got to ask the celebrities that have come out. I mean, you see Bill Murray, and he seems to be around the Cubs when good things happen, and Jim Belushi, that type of thing, Eddie Vedder. Bill Murray kind of, I don't know, he gets a little silly for me. Eddie Vedder seems to be the one that is really a personable guy. Is that what you found?
Oh, yeah. You know, and I met him for the first time. Theo introduced me to him at 15 during that run, and he talked to every reporter, and he's just nice. He gave me guitar picks for my kids. So I had two kids. He just has them in his pocket, like these Pearl Jam ones with like cartoon stuff on them. And I've talked to people at work for the Cubs, and they said he knows everyone's name. Not like the players' names, but the people that work around the team. You wouldn't find a guy that's more grateful to be there. You know, he's close with Theo. Like, even if he wasn't, he'd be welcomed. But he and Theo are very, very close. So that makes the difference. But he loves the players. I mean, like, it is great to see, because, you know, we do see celebrities come in there, and I talk to the people that wrangle them sometimes, and some people are nicer than others. He is exceptionally nice and exceptionally grateful to be there. So it's, everyone loves him there, and we love seeing him. We don't make fun of him. And it's funny, we were just talking to Jeff Garland, the comedian, and then some people like him, some people don't. He was talking to those reporters in the clubhouse one day, or not clubhouse, in the dugout, and he said he hates the term celebrity because he thinks it's just like, it basically makes it sound like he has no talent. He's just like he's a celebrity fan, but he loves the team too. So it's cool when you see those people that are actually like celebrities that are good people, you know what I mean?
Do the Cubs just kind of put up with Bill Murray?
He doesn't come around much.
Oh.
You know, I think that was more in the 80s and early 90s. When he was there for the World Series, man, he was happy. And it was like one of those things where, yeah, I'd roll my eyes at it before, but we talked to him in the clubhouse, and he was great. He had this great quote I used in the book, and I used at the end of my World Series column just about dreams coming true. Like, you could see he was really, like, it meant something to him. It wasn't about being Bill Murray. So, yeah, we don't, besides that, like, we don't see him too much anymore. I remember my wife saying to me, I think in the late 80s, she was sitting behind him at a Cubs game, and he offered her an ice cream. That's about the extent of that. And the time after Game 6, I saw him get pushed out of a bar at 2 a.m. by Chris Chelios in Cleveland.
Somewhat inebriated?
Pushed him into a cab.
All right, this book is If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Chicago Cubs, Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box by John Greenberg. He's an editor-in-chief, founding editor-in-chief, and lead columnist of the Atlantic Chicago. You can read him there, but you got to pick up this book if you have any interest in baseball whatsoever, especially the Chicago Cubs. John, just a fantastic book full of stories, and that's what makes baseball so special, especially for the historical Chicago Cubs. Great book. Thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.